into when you met your husband?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I kind of always knew him too, because we went to St. Paul's Lutheran Church, and his family did too, of course. But he was 7 years older than I, and of course he seemed really grown up. In fact, he was my school teacher 1 year, or Sunday school teacher 1 year. And of course we always kidded about that, because I didn't always know my lesson as well as I should have known. But anyway, we went together pretty steady. There were certain interruptions in the romances, you know, as there quite often is. But so actually it was 7 years after we started going together before we got married. And we got married on the 5th of February, 1944, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church.
And we should say his name was?
Oh, I guess so. His name was Richard Schluter. Yes, most important thing. Most important thing.
And what was his occupation?
At that time, he was trained to teach school, but he did not... He had taught school some, but the schools were very limited. The country schools were getting very, very little financing from taxes and from the state. And so he was teaching when I went to high school, and I suppose that's why because he taught over by Glen Lake one school, and he taught at Port Nida School. And he taught 2 extra months in a year so that those schools could continue to receive state help. And many teachers did at that time. He got $40 or $45 a month each when he was teaching. But he had gone to County Normal. There used to be a County Normal at Northport where they trained teachers. You had to only go a year after high school. And he went there with several others along with several others in the county that had gone. And then he started going to Ferris and to Central Michigan for further education on extension courses. And he spent one summer at Ferris, and he had gone a year to Central. And so he never quite got his degree because he just quit working at it. He did not want to be a school teacher to start with. But that was what his aunt and uncle would agree to. He wanted to go to law school. Of course, he has a little history in his life here too that I might tell you. His father was killed by a train when he was 2 years old, and at that time the family lived on Gothier Road, which is off from 645, and so the mother, there were three children at the time, Walter Schluter and Harvey Schluter. And Rich was in between, he was the middle one. And so, of course, one of her brothers, I guess, helped her, you know, try to keep the family together. And she remarried, and didn't work out. And so it ended up, then she remarried again and had another child. And that man was killed in a car accident. And so Rich was rather bounced around during all of that time, of course, and he was at his grandma Hunky's down here on the corner, by Christmas Tree Corner, this little square house. And of course the aunts and uncles and them were there on a Sunday afternoon, and he was probably around 6, and he went up to his Aunt Agnes Schluter and asked her if he could go home with her. Oh yeah, sure, he could go home with her. Well, nothing more was said, and they started for home. They had no children. And they got part of the way home, and there was a little rustle in the back seat, and he had hidden under a robe in the back seat. So he lived with them. They raised him as his own.
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, it is, you know. They were really parents to him.
It's a case of a child choosing his own destiny, isn't it?
Right. And he made a good choice.
Early age.
Yeah. He made a very good choice.
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah. But then when we got married, we lived on the end of, well, you turn to where Betty Vance lives now on River Street. Mm-hmm. And we lived at the end of 2nd Street on the left, right behind Henry Stephens' house.
Oh, yes.
There was an upstairs apartment there that belonged to Mrs. Fred Perrell. And we used the downstairs for a garage and then storage because it wasn't heated. And then the upstairs, we had a nice little apartment. And that's where we were living when John was born. Mm-hmm. And then when John was two, he was born in 1946. When 1948, we started building the house we live in here where we're talking. And we moved in to this house on November 1st of that year, of 1948. And then the year, on November 5th of the following year, Jim was born. And he now lives in Sutton's Bay. Of course, John teaches school here in Leland, and Jim and his family live north of Sutton's Bay on 633.
He works for the,
he's a shop superintendent for the County Road Commission. And then, 22 months later, on September 28th, 1951.
Yeah. Bob was born.
And of course, his family lives here in Leland on Grand Avenue. And then almost 7 years later, on May 14th, then Tom was born. Never had any girls at all. Dad always wanted one, but he never got any. But, of course, everybody was hoping we'd have a boy, a girl when Tom came. And I said, you might as well be a boy, because it'll be a tomboy anyway. But
let's talk about the house here.
Okay.
And the location.
Okay.
How you chose to be here.
Well, we were in the apartment, and we'd been there a good 4 years, perhaps, and we decided that we had always wanted to buy or build, and we decided we'd better look for some property.
So Rich took off one day, and
he decided he'd talk to Emil Patterson, who lived on Grand Avenue, where Dr. Varley lives now, and because he was sort of a real estate man and whatever. And he never had to go to anyone else because Mr. Patterson had these two lots for sale on Mill Street, plus two lots farther toward the mouth of the river, where the Hanpeters now live. And so they were $400. And so he came home and we talked about it and we decided we'd buy them. And we thought, $400, you know, that was a lot of money. But we had it, so we bought them. And then we didn't build for, I can't even remember, yeah, John must have been the... We lived there for a while and just started making preparations for building. And Pete Johnson built our house. Pete Nelson was assistant carpenter. And Pete Johnson's nephew, Guilford Johnson, from down in the Edmore Six Lakes area down near Grand Rapids, came up and spent the summer, or he had spent a year or so, I guess, helped working with Pete. He was getting into the trade. And so they built our house. It was not finished by any means when we came in. I had kitchen cupboards with no doors. There was no woodwork on anything, no window casings or anything like that. We had the bathroom equipment was in, and then we had tile on the floor. But no walls weren't finished or anything like that. And Bob was, in 1952 was when we finally got all of that done, and we had it all painted and everything the way we...
You know, this brings us back to how it was when you were little and the chores your mother had.
Mm-hmm.
At the farm.
Oh, yes, right. Because he was a general farmer, and so he had cattle, and he had a dairy herd usually, a small one, six cows usually. he always had horses and just a pair. And my mother always had chickens and quite a good sized garden. And there was a small apple orchard on that farm where we got fruit, and there was some pears there and so on. But she always took care of the chickens, and she helped my dad milk morning and night, because they'd milk by hand. Mm-hmm. They got up early. My dad was always an early riser. He had started working in a lumber camp when he was 14 years old as a chore boy. And so he had to be up like 3 o'clock in the morning to have the horses fed and everything, so that they'd be ready to go when the men had to go to work. And so he was always an early riser. She did that. And then, of course, they separated the milk at the house. There was a separator in the pantry, a machine. And of course, she always took care of all of the cream and the milk. And they always had some little pigs every spring, so that which they butchered later. And my mother, of course, she didn't work on the farm very much. I can remember her helping hoe corn a few times, and she took care of the yard around the house. Of course, she didn't mow it that much. She'd mow it, you know, a couple times a year, maybe with a bigger mower with the horses, but that was a terrible job to do, you know, with the trees and things around. But she always kept the yard nice, and as soon as she could get, she got a lawnmower, and, you know, and for years there was no... There was a very deep well, and it was very hard to, and so my dad had gotten a gasoline motor to pump the water. And then in later years, he had a windmill put up, which is still standing on the farm, yeah. And she'd do what she could. As you know, we'd see that there was water in the tank for the cows when they'd come to water to drink, and the horses if they happened to be out. But she mainly took care of her garden and saw to it that there was things in the house and in the basement stored for winter, canned and preserved, you know. And we always had nice fresh whole milk and fresh eggs. And she always raised her own little chickens. She'd hatch them herself. I can remember the old mother hen sitting on the nest with some clutch of eggs underneath them, and cross as a bear if anybody came near them, you know, because they... protecting their nest. And in fact, my folks built the house, had the house built that we lived in. When they moved there, I never heard of any house on that farm. There was a barn, and apparently there was another shed, which we later used for a chicken coop. But my mother and dad lived in that shed. They got married in August, and the house was being built at that time. So for several months, they lived in that kind of a shed. It probably was 15 feet long and 12 feet wide, something like that, or maybe a little longer. While the house was being finished. Then they built the house and a garage out by the, because they always had a Model T car. I never remember not having a car. But in the summer when the summer people were up at Traverse Lake and Lime Lake, there was one family there, she would churn butter to sell, and she sold what we call spring chickens, the springers we always called them. And so we had that, you know, to do, and she sold eggs. And we always, every Saturday night we went to Cedar to get groceries and so on. And I remember Phyllis Bonnick's dad having the store, and her Uncle Frank was in the bank. And he had, there's my son, you want to stop that for a second?
Cedar generally.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Phyllis Sponick was Phyllis Carnahan, as you know. Her dad used to test the cream in his store, you know, for the, and then you got, the men got, the farmers got paid according to the amount of butter fat that was in the cream that they brought in. They got so much a pound, and then it was figured out by the way it tested It was weighed and then tested, and I don't know just exactly the formula that was used, but anyway, if you had good cows and good separator and everything, you got a good test on your cream.
And this was before pasteurized milk?
Oh, yes. They didn't have pasteurized milk up here. Mm-hmm. I had very little pasteurized milk until, well, after Rich and I were married. He probably had, John probably had more raw milk than pasteurized. We used to get it from Snyder's Dairy over by Lake Leona. But and then we always shopped. Well, we shopped at Sponics for groceries as long as the store was there. But that burned, and so I can't remember quite in the interim there. But we for a while we traded at a store down the other end of town that was across from Black's Meat Market on Main Street, also run by a man by the name of Frank Stefanik, and. Then I don't know if that closed or what, but then we traded with Plevas, which were across from where the bank was on Main Street, and which is still in operation.
Tell me, to go back just a little bit, in the farmhouse when you were growing up, was there inside plumbing outside?
Oh, no. There was not. We had a wood box that had, was built so that it had a drawers and you could, it was slanted front so that you could put the wood in. Then there was a drawer across the top where I remember my mother kept shoe polish and little odds and ends that she needed. And then the shelf on the top would hold 3 pails of water. And that was in a hallway between, that went from the kitchen to the bedroom. There was a pantry out of the kitchen which made that hallway. When you came in the kitchen door, there was a pantry to the left, quite a large pantry. And that made that little hallway. And we also had then a shelf in there with a wash basin. And there was always a dipper in the water thing. And there was a pail to dump your dirty water. And big roller towel with linen crash. Okay. And a mirror. So my dad would shave there, and we always washed there. We took baths in wash tubs in front of the, either behind the heater in the living room in the winter or in the summer in front of the stove in the, I remember my mother found me with measles one Sunday morning. She was giving me a bath. I was all covered with measles. But anyway, it was quite a few years. I'm trying to think, in the time that my mother died in 1945, and at that time, there were no facilities yet in the house. We had no electricity, simply because the lines weren't coming through. Now, on 651, Michigan Public Service had electrical power. My grandpa and grandma Grinstone had electrical power almost as long as I could remember. But we never had it because it cost several hundreds, probably more than $1,000 to bring the line in from that road to where we lived. And there were no other houses in between to help take care of the expense. So the full expense would have been ours.
Yeah.
And so they never had lights at the farm until Consumers Power. I think they probably bought Michigan Public Service in the interim. Brought the power from Frankfort and down up M-22 past Traverse Lake and came up north of Sugarloaf, mm-hmm. through the valley there. And then everybody around there then had electricity. Yeah. But we all were in the same boat. Nobody had electricity.
You had kerosene lamps.
Kerosene lamps, and my father and mother had a power gasoline lamp that would hang from the ceiling. It had a tank on the bottom, quite a long pipe, and two mantles, and a frosted globe that would fit over it, and it ran under pressure, and they would fill it with gasoline and then pump the pressure up, and then there was a valve on there to turn. They'd light the mantles, and it would hiss as it was working. And a lot of people were afraid of them. I don't know how many years we had one, because then the Aladdin kerosene lamp came into being that also had a mantle, And so they had either one or two of those. And that that made nice light too, like the gasoline lamp did, or like electricity. But you had to carry your lights around, you know, wherever you were. We have lights in the kitchen. Well, then when supper was over at night, we'd carry whatever kitchen lights we had into the dining room or living room, wherever we were going to sit. And but when we had the gasoline lamp, there was the ceiling was made, even molded. There was a circle there with a hook down, put in when the house was built there and in the kitchen. And you could hang that lamp. It was a very easy hook to hang the lamp. And it hung in the middle of the room. And so it was many years before there was any facilities at the house.
Well, what kind of stove did your mother cook?
My mother cooked on a wood stove. And there were a good many years she didn't have refrigeration. Probably in around 1930, 29 or 30, she got refrigeration. She got, my uncle lived in Detroit at the time, and he brought up an icebox from Detroit that was in real good condition, a secondhand one. And that's what we had for refrigeration. And my dad and my uncles would put up ice, and there was an ice house at my Grand Knightson's, which was just down the road a bit. And that was enough for my mother and dad and for my grandma and my uncle that lived there. And so that was always quite an experience too when they did the ice cutting in the winter. But my mother died in 1945, and then my dad remarried in 1947. And they, when she was born in Traverse City, Clara Van Curen, her name was, and she was always used to the facilities that you would have. But she wanted to move to the farm. She had a pretty nice house where she lived in Acme, but they lived about a year or so without the power yet. And then, of course, she had the equipment when the power did come through. Then she had an electric refrigerator that she put in. They still cooked with a cook stove, though, for a while until they did some remodeling in the kitchen and so on. But my mother knew how to handle that cook stove. She could make it do whatever she wanted to do. Of course, the way ironed with flat irons that were heated on the stove. And I remember the ironing board laid between, my mother had a little kitchen cabinet by the kitchen door, just as you came in. And then the table where we ate, they were about the same height. And she had, her ironing board was not on a stand. She laid it on that one end on one and one end on the other table, and that's where she ironed.
Which would work.
Yeah. It was padded, but it wasn't as finely honed on the ends as they are nowadays. It was harder to do shirt sleeves and all that kind of stuff. But I was taught to iron and to do a certain amount of housework. I didn't do a whole lot of housework. And to bake and so forth. That is cakes and things. I didn't bake bread because that was too long a process. Of course, and I was in school.
You were in school.
The better part of the day.
Tell me about general farming.
Okay, well, my dad's farm was only about 60 acres, and his fields usually ran around 4 acres per field, maybe a little more. But he rotated his crops. He was a good farmer, and he would rotate his crops and go from grain to hay, and then there would be pasture for the cattle for a certain number of years, and then in the meantime, then, when it was broken up, I think the first thing that went in was potatoes, and then corn, and then grain, and then back to hay. Because the hay, if I remember right, the hay seed, the alfalfa seed, was planted in with the grain, drilled into the ground with the grain, so that when you cut the oats that year, then your alfalfa was coming up, and you had a pasture there next year. You know, it was, we went around. Well, then, and then, of course, he had the cattle. But later years, I was still in school, he decided everybody was starting to buy cherry trees. So he bought, I think he had 400 cherry trees, so he converted some of it.
Remember about when that was?
probably in the early 1930s. I just can't remember whether I was had already started high school or if I was still in grade school. I just can't remember. I can remember them planning them because the gentleman, whose name was John Bash, lived about a mile from us. He was a bachelor that lived on the road where I walked to school. Helped him plant, and they didn't have it surveyed. And when they got going, their rows were crooked. So they had to take out the trees they had planted, and then they had to get the surveyor to come from Sutton's Bay and really set it up so they get it cross and square. And I can remember them doing that, but that's about the only thing. But I was a little older. I was probably a young teenager or very close to it when he went into Cherry's. But that was the only orchard he had for several years until I was working, and then he and I together bought the second set of trees that he brought up closer to the house. Of course, in the meantime, then by the time he started cutting down on his cattle and his farming somewhat. My mother wasn't feeling well, and he just gradually went out of farming and more into the cherries. He planted a couple more lots of cherries. But he had, on the one corner of the woods, there was a wood, of the farm, there was a wood lot. And I think there's probably somebody living in that little area right now, but he always went down in the wintertime and cut his own wood alone. When I think of it now, it makes me shiver because, but my mother, I know, would go down and check sometimes to see how he was because she, I think, worried about him too, you know. And then he'd skid the logs out with a horse or two horses, whatever he needed, and they'd be brought up to the house area, and then they'd get hire a buzzsaw, and some people would come, and they, family or friends would come, and they'd buzz up the wood, and I can remember helping pilot. I can remember seeing them buzz once or twice. You know, it was fascinating to me because it made a lot of noise, but it was.
And he had been, you said, a chore boy in a lumber camp?
Yeah, he did. He helped the cook, and he was also had to see that the horses were, I don't know if he took care of the horses except for the seeing that they got fed in the morning, got their food early enough so that they could be done eating and drinking and so forth before they had to go out and work. And then he'd go in, and when he got that down, of course, then the cook was getting breakfast, he had to go in and wake the men that were working. Of course, they got up real early too. And then they'd have breakfast, and they had a humongous breakfast, you know, meat and potatoes and, you know. No, they had a lot. Yeah, they had a lot of hard work to do. And then at noon, it was his job to take a horse, and they had a smaller sled that they would put the food on in cans, like cream cans, hot, and whatever needed to be taken to the men. He had to take that down into the woods for the men that were working.
What lumber camp was this?
You know, I can't tell you. I think he worked for Ruth Hart's, which is south of Cedar. And I don't know where else. I think he worked at a couple of different places, but I honestly don't know. But I know he has pictures, and a lot of people in that area did work for the Ruthards. And they had a farm, but I think they also had, maybe, I might be wrong on that, but he had a lot of, we had some pictures marked, you know, the Ruthard farm.
That would be interesting to follow up more.
Yes.
If we do.
Oh, the lumbering would be, yeah.
Of all the lumbering.
Mm-hmm. Because I honestly don't know where he was. John, you want to go down and put wood?
Inza, tell me a little bit more about general farming. Part of it, of course, was to raise your own crops to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Then how did it work for the rest?
Okay. Dad only raised enough grain to take care of corn and oats. He never raised any other grain except oats. But people did raise rye and wheat in the area, but he never did. He had a small farm. And that was kept at home. And the corn was put into a silo, for cattle feed. And that was when all the neighbors would come in and they'd help do all that, break out the ears of corn and the ripe ears, and then they'd get together and they'd fill the silo. Each one had their jobs, you know, to do, and they'd come with their teams and haul. And the potatoes, they were sold. They were stored in the basement. Usually there was no heat, of course. We just had a wood heater in the dining room part of the house and the cook stove. And, of course, there was no heat in the basement. And they were stored there, and sometimes there would be some sold immediately, depending on what the price was. But then they'd hold a certain amount of them to see if they could get a little more. And they would hire, well, I always picked potatoes, and the neighbor kid, like I said, we had school vacation for potato digging. And there would be neighbors that would come in and pick for so much a bushel, probably a penny a bushel. And my mother would give them dinner, and sometimes they got supper too. But they later years, they carried their own lunches. But at first, they were fed. And they used to dig. I can't quite remember. I know that my dad dug potatoes by hand, like the old-fashioned hook and so forth, maybe at the very beginning. But my main remembrance is of them digging with a mechanical digger that was drawn by horses. Mm-hmm. And then they would haul the potatoes to the house, and there was a certain window where they could get that they could get the potatoes in. And then later, if you're going to sell them,